You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Yesterday, CBC News released the results of an investigative report into refugee acceptance rates by individual members of the Immigration and Refugee Board. Reporter David Mackay said his analysis of 3 years of statistics on claims shows some members of the board were overwhelmingly refusing claims, while others were overwhelmingly approving them. Sean Rehag is a law professor at Osgoode Hall in Toronto. He's done an independent analysis of the numbers and come up with similar results. Sean Rehag joins me this morning from Ontario. Hello, Sean.
Hello.
How much variation is there among individual board members?
Well, as the CBC report indicated, there's quite a bit of variation. So there's some board members who virtually always grant refugee status, and there are other board members who very infrequently grant refugee status. And maybe I could just give you a couple of examples. In 2008, there was one board member, Gilles Guinette, who decided about 200 cases, and her success rate was about 90%. In the same year, Diane Tinker heard about 120 cases, and her grant rate was about 40%. There are other board members, Jean Beaubien-Duc, his grant rate was about 7% in the same year. So you can see really huge variations in the grant rates across board members.
So the last case that you mentioned, that board member would have only approved 7% of people for refugee status in Canada.
Yeah, and there are several others who only grant refugee status in less than 10% of cases.
Now, what are the dangers here for genuine refugees whose claims are rejected?
Well, that's a really serious issue. It's a serious issue because refugee claims have huge impacts on the lives of claimants. So you can imagine a scenario where someone makes a refugee claim. They, in fact, do face a risk of persecution, a risk of death, a risk of torture in their home country. And because they're unlucky and they end up before an IRB member who very infrequently grants refugee claims, their claim may be improperly denied. And the result of that is that they could be sent back to a country where they face persecution, torture, or even death.
Now, Immigration Minister Jason Kenney says that he's been told that board members have such hugely varying rates because of the countries they're assigned to. For example, if a board member is deciding on Mexico, the overall rejection rate is 90%, and so their personal rate just reflects that. Do you think that's a reasonable explanation?
Well, I think the minister is correct to say that part of the variation is due to some of these factors. So it is important to acknowledge that IRB members may specialize in particular regions of the world. And if someone is hearing, for example, many cases from Mexico, they're going to have a lower grant rate than if they're hearing, for example, many cases of people from Colombia, just because right now Colombia is quite a bit more dangerous than Mexico. So the minister is correct to point that out. That having been said, what I've done in my study of the IRB member grant rates is I've tried to take those factors into consideration. And so just to give you an example, if you look only at decisions involving claimants from China, and you look at two board members in 2008, one, Yuma McConan, decided 100 cases from China in 2008, the grant rate for McConan was 86%. In the same year, Diane Tinker heard 96 cases of claimants from China, and her grant rate was 45%. So while the minister is correct to point out that some of the variation in grant rates across IRB members is likely due to regional specialization, even when you take regional specialization into account, you still see massive variations in grant rates.
Well, what other possible reasons are there for such widely fluctuating rates?
Well, people have put forward a whole number of possible reasons. So there may be other reasons relating to specialization of board members. Board members in different cities, for example, may be hearing different subsets of cases. So if you happen to be in Vancouver hearing cases from China, for example, you may be hearing a different subset of cases than if you're sitting in Toronto. Maybe people from different parts of China are going to Vancouver and different parts of China are going to Toronto, and that might possibly explain some of the variation. So there are a number of factors that you'd want to take into account. I suspect that one of the main factors, though, is the preferences of individual IRB members. So there is a sense that although many IRB members are doing their jobs properly, it's a very difficult job, they're taking into consideration the proper factors, there are some IRB members who are known to the lawyers who represent refugee claimants. There are some IRB members who are known to be particularly harsh on refugee claimants and others to be particularly generous. And I think that is simply one of the factors that's explaining these variations here, that some board members see their job essentially as to weed out fraudulent claims, to guard Canada's borders against those who would abuse our generosity, as the minister sometimes says, and other IRB members who view their job as being about offering protection to people whose human rights are being abused abroad, and that might be one of the factors that explains these differences.
So then that means if you were a lawyer bringing a refugee claimant in front of the board, that to some extent you might feel that your client was being exposed to the luck of the draw in terms of who they might end up being heard before.
Yeah. Again, I'd like to emphasize that there are many IRB members who are doing a really great job. It's a very difficult decision, and so I want to emphasize that. That having been said, there are a small number of IRB members who are known to either almost always go positive or almost always go negative, and lawyers arguing cases in front of those IRB members certainly would feel that the claim is being decided not based on the merits, but based on these extra-legal considerations, and that, you know, in some cases it really just is about the luck of the draw.
What kind of process is there that might determine if a board member made an error in judgment?
We all know that, you know, everyone makes mistakes. All decision makers will make some mistakes, and the system does have various mechanisms in place to try to address errors in refugee decisions. The most important of which is that you can go to the federal court and you can ask for leave from the federal court. Basically, you ask for permission from the federal court to have the federal court review the decision. So that is a possibility for if someone believes that their claim was denied because they just happened to get a board member who is harsh towards claimants. One possibility is to go to the federal court. The problem with that route is that in the federal court, all that you can really argue is that there was a mistake of law that was made in your refugee decision, that the IRB member made a legal error. It's very difficult to simply argue, well, you know, that the IRB member made a mistake in their factual findings. And that's what usually determines most claims. The outcome is usually hinges on the factual findings that are made by the IRB members. So if you have an IRB member who is harsh towards claimants and doesn't believe the story recounted by the claimant, it's very difficult to use the federal court process to correct that. So in theory, you've got this opportunity to challenge decisions made by the IRB at the federal court, but most decisions which turn on credibility findings by the IRB member, most of those decisions are very difficult to challenge.
And how wide is that window there for that opportunity? What percentage of requests would be heard? And then I understand that they would be heard just on the basis of errors in law.
So when you ask for permission from the federal court to have the federal court review the decision, the success rates they vary a little bit from year to year, but they hover around 10 to 15%. So and the federal court doesn't provide reasons when they deny leave to judicially review the decision. So only about 1 in 10 folks who say that an error was made in their refugee decision, only about 1 in 10 of those people would actually end up in front of the federal court. And then when they're actually there, they're restricted in terms of what kinds of arguments they can make, which basically means that that the federal court process can't catch all the mistakes that are being made by the IRB. Now, Parliament did, when it passed its last immigration legislation in 2001, it created what's called the Refugee Appeal Division of the Immigration and Refugee Board, and this was basically an internal appeal. So if you were unhappy with your refugee decision that was made at the IRB, you could have that decision appealed on its merits by another branch of the Immigration and Refugee Board. And that's what it actually says in our current immigration legislation. But the government, initially the Liberal government and then a Conservative government, they've decided not to implement these provisions of the legislation. So although the legislation says that there's an appeal, in fact, we don't have that that appeal, which would address some of the concerns that we've been discussing.
Now, last week, the Conservatives voted against a private member's bill that would have forced the government to establish an appeal board within a certain time period. Why did they vote against that?
Well, you'd have to speak with the MPs who actually voted against it. The minister has come out and explained why, in his view, the Refugee Appeal Division should not be implemented. And in his view, the system is, the refugee determination system is too vulnerable to abuse as it is. He believes that there's a problem with what he calls fraudulent claims, and he thinks adding the appeal that Parliament, you know, set out in our current immigration legislation of actually implementing that appeal would simply make things worse. It's important when you evaluate this explanation. It's important to keep in mind that although the minister indicates that there are many ways that refugees can currently appeal negative refugee determinations. He talks about appeal, judicially reviewing the decision in the federal court. He also talks about other immigration procedures, such as pre-removal risk assessment and humanitarian compassion applications for Canadian permanent resident. The minister discusses all of these various procedures, but none of them actually allow a claimant who had a refugee decision where the IRB members simply didn't believe the refugee story. None of the system, none of the procedures allow for that decision to be meaningfully challenged. And so the minister may be correct to say that implementing the Refugee Appeal Division might draw out the process a little bit further. He is, in my view, wrong to say that the existing system can catch mistakes in refugee determinations.
The board used to, when a refugee claimant came to the board, they used to have two board members, and that was reduced to one in 2001. So given this this recent report talking about the variation in the rates of acceptance by individual board members, do you think there is... what do you think it's going to take to get the government to implement a system that has some kind of checks and balances for legitimate refugee claimants?
Yeah, well, it's an important point to note that in the prior to 2001, the idea was that you made your refugee claim in front of two IRB members, and you only had to persuade one of those two IRB members that your claim was well-founded in order for you to get a refugee status. And so what the IRB could do is where there was a concern about one particular IRB member being unduly harsh towards refugee claimants, you could match that person with another more experienced, more moderate IRB member and ensure that people would not be denied their refugee claim simply because they were unlucky and had their decision being made by someone who was harsh towards claimants. So there was a protection built into the previous system. When the Liberal government brought in the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act in 2001, they got rid of that procedure whereby there were two board members hearing all decisions, and instead replaced that that form of protection with a new form of protection, the Refugee Appeal Division, so that if you were unlucky and you got an IRB member who was harsh, who was making your first decision, you could at least appeal that decision on the merits within the IRB. So it was explicitly presented as a trade-off. We're going to lose the two-member panels, but we're going to move to a system which is going to have a meaningful appeal. Because the government has brought in the first part of that, we now have claims before single board members, but not the second part of that, not the Refugee Appeal Division. There's a serious danger that people who are, in fact, refugees are not being recognized as such and may be deported to countries where they face persecution, torture, or death. So what can we do now? Well, I think that the public in general, as well as advocates for refugees more specifically, need to put pressure on both government MPs but also opposition MPs to pass legislation that would immediately implement this refugee appeal division. It's important to note that the vote last week, where the cabinet members billed it would immediately implement the refugee appeal division, where it did not pass, it was extremely close. In fact, it was a tie, and it was the Speaker for the House who had to cast the deciding vote. Now, there were a number of opposition MPs, including, for example, Bob Gray, who were not present for that vote. So given that we have a minority government scenario, if the opposition, the Liberal Party, the NDP, and the Bloc Québécois were to get together and were to actually decide that this was a priority, they could pass legislation that would implement this refugee appeal division. So I think one of the options is to put pressure on all MPs, but a second option is to put particular pressure on the opposition MPs.
Well, thanks very much for joining me this morning and talking about this, Sean.
Well, thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Sean Rehag. He's a law professor at Osgoode Hall in Toronto.